From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, The Gospel According to Hollywood. Passover and Easter are coming up, so today we look at Hollywood biblical epics. Charlton Heston remembers leading 8,000 extras across the Red Sea in the Ten Commandments. Elmer Bernstein tells us how he wrote the music that accompanied their exodus. Martin Scorsese shares his frustrations about the shortage of extras in The Last Temptation of Christ. Then Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis tell us about making the Roman epic Spartacus. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. House Republicans have marked their first 100 days in office. Dozens of them held a rally on the steps of the Capitol to talk about the contract with America. The GOP had promised to bring the 10 contract items up for a vote within the first 100 days. They did it within 93 days, and 9 items passed the House. Speaker Newt Gingrich says the contract was a serious agreement with the American people.
More than any group in modern times, we campaigned on a promise, we worked on that promise, and we kept that promise.
The contract items have been sent to the Senate, and it's not clear how many will pass there, much less be signed into law by President Clinton. But Mr. Clinton told a group of newspaper editors today he wasn't elected to rack up a lot of vetoes, and he says his party and the Republicans can work together on issues like welfare reform and spending cuts.
I am absolutely convinced if we are tough enough and wise enough and unpolitical enough to put the interests of ordinary Americans first and to really focus on the future, that our best days are before us, better than we can even imagine. But it all depends on what we do at this crossroads. Let's get busy.
President Clinton speaking in Dallas. Plans to cut billions of dollars in already approved spending are in limbo. The House and Senate have passed different bills to do this. The Senate has voted unanimously in favor of $16 billion in cuts for education, housing, jobs, and scores of other programs. The Senate bill keeps President Clinton's National Service Program. The House has approved a $17 billion package with deeper cuts in many programs. House Republicans say they'll still try for major cuts when negotiators meet to reconcile the bills next month, but Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle says that would send the package back to ground zero. The United States is warning Haiti that several political opponents of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide are on a hit list. The Pentagon says it has a list of targeted Haitians. Defense Department spokeswoman Christine Shelley says 27 people are listed.
The U.S. has received from a variety of sources information which is of varying quality regarding possible threats to individual Haitians. We have made this information available to our mission in Port-au-Prince and have asked that they in turn discuss with the U.N. mission and the government of Haiti the appropriate action to be taken in cases where the information on a threat would appear to be credible.
A British man scheduled to die in the Georgia Electric chair tonight has had his execution delayed for 3 days. A federal judge is reviewing the case of Nicholas Lee Ingram, who was convicted of murdering a 55-year-old man in 1983. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 19 points at 4,186. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Tobacco companies have won a delay in a Florida lawsuit against them. A state judge has granted the companies a 3-month stay in the case. Florida is trying to make the industry pay for the cost of treating sick smokers. The delay also has a political angle. The Florida legislature is debating whether to overturn a law that worked against tobacco firms. The law had prevented the tobacco companies from charging that smokers share the blame for their health problems. The Labor Department reports the nation's unemployment rate edged up a tenth of a point to 5.5% in March. It's another indication of an economic slowdown. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics told lawmakers on Capitol Hill that the increase could be traced to a slowdown in manufacturing, which saw its first drop in employment in 15 months. Catherine Abraham says the sector had been adding 40,000 jobs a month since last fall. Many economists trace the drop in manufacturing jobs to the Federal Reserve's series of interest rate hikes over the last year to control inflation. California Democrat Peter Stark expressed some concern that efforts to engineer a soft landing for the economy are beginning to hurt his state and others. Overall, the service areas of the economy, including healthcare, finance, and real estate, showed gains in employment last month. Construction also posted surprisingly strong numbers. Analysts attribute that to unseasonably warm weather for March in many parts of the country. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
Bosnian Serbs have shelled a suburb of Sarajevo for a second day today. All checkpoints into the city are closed. The Serbs are also threatening to shoot down all UN helicopters that fly over their territory. The rising tension between the Serbs and the UN comes after French peacekeepers asked NATO warplanes to buzz Serbian positions in a show of force. The fighting is growing in Bosnia. All sides have refused to extend the ceasefire. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Lord, I shall give these laws unto thy people. Hear me! Oh, hear me! All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15... Ten commandments for all to obey.
On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, as many people prepare for Easter and Passover, we salute Hollywood's biblical epics. Mel Brooks spoofed the biblical epic in his movie History of the World Part 1. Our first guest, Charlton Heston, starred in The Real Thing.
From the burning bush, O Lord, you charged me to bring the people to this holy mountain, to behold your glory and receive your law. What have I left undone?
Charlton Heston was Moses in The Ten Commandments, which is broadcast on TV nearly every year at about this time. In fact, ABC will show it this Sunday night. Heston's booming voice reverberated in other biblical spectacles like Ben-Hur and The Greatest Story Ever Told. I spoke with Heston in 1990. In the Ten Commandments, you had to lead and to speak to a cast of thousands. Can you describe what went into one of those scenes, or one of the really large scenes where all the extras were?
Well, the Exodus is, I suppose, one of the largest scenes of that kind ever filmed.
Mm-hmm.
It had 8,000 human beings and 5,000 animals, and it took, to get the shots with all those people, you could only do about five takes a day, because you... To get them back to where they started from took hours. And it's the kind of film that obviously can never be made again. They won't ever make Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge in the River Kwai or Ben-Hur, any of those films again, because they're far, far too expensive. I saw they ran the Ben-Hur budget, the original budget, which turned up in somebody's file drawer, through a modern computer program that production managers use when they're budgeting films. To make Ben-Hur today would cost $127,800,000.
Wow. So tell me something about what it was like to do the Exodus scene and the crossing the Red Sea scene with...
Well, you need the stick. You have to have the stick to do it. Did you notice what a nice day it was in New York yesterday? You're welcome. I'm glad to do it. Glad to help. But obviously those scenes are... In a sense, the English actors call NAR, no acting required. If you stand in front of 8,000 people in the Egyptian desert and lift up a stick and say, "Bear us out of Egypt, O Lord, as an eagle bears its young upon its wings," you don't need to act that. The scene does it for you. you are overwhelmed by the reality of what is around you.
Yeah, it must give you a real sense of power.
Indeed it does.
Even though you know it's all stage, you've still got, what, 8,000 people following
you. Yes, yes. It's quite an awesome experience.
Mm-hmm. You did the voice of God, right? In the scene where Moses is on the mountain and God is telling the Ten Commandments.
Well, which I think is perfectly logical, because where do we hear the voice of God? Inside our own heads, right? And whose voice speaks inside your head?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'd like to ask you about the chariot race scene in Ben-Hur, which is, Ben-Hur won, 11 Academy Awards, mm-hmm. and the chariot race scene has always been considered one of the really important action sequences.
Category for chariot races, though.
Right. so you had to...
It is regarded, I suppose, as the best action sequence ever filmed, but it didn't win an award.
You had to learn how to actually drive a chariot for this?
Yes, I went over some 6 weeks before we started shooting, and Yakima Kanat, who directed the race sequence, personally taught me to drive. And by the time we were ready to begin the picture... I was a minimally competent charioteer, but as I pointed out to Yak one day while we were resting the horses after working a couple of hours with him, I said, you know, Yak, I can handle this team pretty well now, but there's just the one team out here, and when we start shooting this sucker, there's going to be 8 other teams, and I'm not so sure about I can cut that or not. And he looked at me and he said, Chuck, you just stay in the chariot. I guarantee you're going to win the damn race. As indeed I did.
So was everybody, were most of the other drivers stunt drivers so they could get out of your way
indeed,
real quick?
All of them. Mm-hmm. Steve Boyd, who unhappily had not been cast until he only had about 3 weeks work in the chariot. But he drove some sequences as well.
Mm-hmm. There was all these scenes where...
In any action sequence, mm-hmm. if the principal has been trained to do whatever it is he's supposed to do well enough to be photographed doing it, you are surrounded by professionals. I mean, they were not about to run over me if I fell out of the chariot. I don't think they were.
And they didn't really run over Stephen Boyd when he fell out, right?
No. No. What was an accident... was I drove a great deal of the sequences,
mm-hmm.
but the scene where Ben-Hur is thrown out of the chariot when it jumps the wreck was not planned. He was not supposed to go out of the chariot, but he was accidentally thrown out with Groot, and I didn't do that. Joe Kanat, Yak's son, but Joe was thrown out of the chariot, managed to throw himself clear, and was only scratched. If the chariot had run over him, it would have killed him because those things weighed 0.5 ton with steel wheels. But then Weiler, who of course directed the picture, saw that footage, and he said, we got to use that shot. And Jack said, I thought Ben-Hur was supposed to win this sucker, Willie. How are we going to get him back in the chariot? And Willie said, well, we'll cut before he falls absolutely clear and have Chuck get in the tongue and climb back in, which I did very quickly.
Charlton Heston, recorded in 1990. The Jews in the film The Ten Commandments marched out of bondage to a stirring score by Elmer Bernstein. Elmer Bernstein is one of the most highly regarded composers working in film. He also wrote the music for The Man with the Golden Arm, Some Came Running, Walk on the Wild Side, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Magnificent Seven, Ghostbusters, Airplane, and The Age of Innocence. In 1991, Bernstein told me about the music that director Cecil B. DeMille asked him to write for The Ten Commandments.
The music for the film... was basically, the concept of the music was Wagnerian because that's what DeMille wanted. When I say Wagnerian, DeMille's concept of the way music should work in a film was that each character should have a theme. And when the character is on the screen that is what you use, their theme, every single time. If there are two characters on the screen, then you would then find some clever way of incorporating both of the themes. In that sense, it's very, well, that's what I mean by a Wagnerian concept.
Let's listen to some of the music you wrote for the Exodus scene for the Ten Commandments. And
I can tell you a funny story about that after you listen to it.
Oh, swell. Okay. And I want to point out something obvious here, which is that it's the beginning starts off as if a shofar is blowing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's pretty obvious. Here we go. This is
that's a funny story, too.
Okay. Well, we'll hear the stories after we hear the music. Okay. Music from the Exodus scene of the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Music from the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Okay, the funny stories.
Well, the first place, you know, when we realized that a shofar was going to be seen on the screen, we had to find somebody to play the shofar. Now, for those who don't know, the shofar is a very ancient instrument made out of a ram's horn. And it sounds very much like not very much, but something like a French horn, a brassy kind of sound. Anyway... where do you find people who play the shofar? Well, who plays shofars? Of course, rabbis, because it's still used in Jewish ceremonies. Well, one day, DeMille got, we must have had, oh, I guess 20 or 30 rabbis on the on the scoring stage. And because we wanted to get different kinds of perspectives on the sound, we had them all over the scoring stage. playing these shofars. But the funny part was it was on a Friday and we were getting dangerously close to twilight time, and we had to stop suddenly because, of course, all the rabbis have to stop working by sundown on Friday. So that was the shofar story. The story about the whole Exodus music is originally, I mean, in the Exodus, there were about 8,000 people in that scene. I don't know how many animals, there are about 8,000 people, and they move quite slowly, necessarily, as 8,000 people would, carrying their belongings with them. So I wrote a sort of very slow, anthem-like processional. DeMille heard it, and he hated it. And I said, well, what was wrong with that? I mean, it looks like the picture to me. He says, that's the trouble, it looks like the picture, and the picture is too slow. He said... now I have to tell you that these 8,000 Hebrews in this scene were being played by 8,000 members of the Egyptian army, which is already pretty funny. And DeMille said, no, I want something with spirit. He said, something like Onward Christian Soldiers. And so finally we have that. That is accounts for the way the Exodus sounds now. But it always seemed funny to me because it was terrifically ecumenical, because... eventually what you have is 8,000 Egyptians playing Hebrews marching off to music like Onward Christian Soldiers.
Elmer Bernstein, recorded in 1991. Martin Scorsese reworked the biblical epic genre when he directed The Last Temptation of Christ, with Willem Dafoe as Christ and Harvey Keitel as Judas. Scorsese spoke at New York University a couple of years ago, and he described the frustrations of filming an epic on location in North Africa with a budget of only $7 million.
I'll never forget the surrounding of the temple. I had five guys from Rome, five stuntmen, and they had Roman costumes on, Roman soldier costumes, right? And I had to, there was a trouble in the temple, whatever, and they look up, they hear a sound, they look up, and Roman soldiers come up, and then Roman soldiers come up, more Roman soldiers, and more over here. Well, I had five guys. Now, the trick was, of course, the trick was to learn, again, go back. The whole picture was storyboarded because we had no time for anything. We had no time to breathe, to get there. And by the time we got to the location, too, this was out in the desert in places, you know. And so I realized it was the old, you know, I drew the shots, and I figured, okay, I know what I have to do. But when I was doing it, I was just, oh, it was so painful. But I said, all right, this is it. Five of them come up here, flash pan, cut, same five guys, same five guys, same five guys, same five guys. That's it. And then they had to fight the Levite guards. And they became the Levite guards on reverses. I'm not kidding. And I said, I can't believe what we're doing. I said, this is, I mean, if I hadn't studied Roger Corman pictures, you would never be able to do this. But I mean, they were the same, the Levite guards. I couldn't believe it. I said, for the reverse, now we got, and they were all yelling in Italian and it was the most despairing moment. And I had just read the reviews for Empire of the Sun and The Last Emperor. From some Time magazine. I said, oh, beautiful, we've got to see the film. But look, they had, oh, look at all the extras he had. Oh, oh, what have I done? I said, maybe I was just too eager to do it. Maybe I should have waited. And Michael Ball, I said, Marty, they're never going to give you that kind of extra for this picture. Let's shoot. Come on, get up, come on, let's go. And it was hysterical. If you look at the temple scene, every shot, the same guys. Every now and then we change a helmet.
Martin Scorsese recorded 2 years ago at NYU. This is Fresh Air. It would be great to have Cecil B. DeMille to help me convince you to call with a pledge. I'd have stirring music behind me. With the help of some reverb, my voice would boom with authority as it commanded a cast of thousands to reach for their checkbooks. Of course, public radio doesn't have the kind of budget that epics are made with, but certainly the truth should be convincing enough. And the truth is, your financial support is needed now more than ever. Thank you. Many stations are fundraising this week. For those who aren't, we've been featuring a special series with our rock historian Ed Ward about small record labels of the past that helped shape today's music. The current alternative music scene is an outgrowth of the punk music of the 80s. Ed Ward says one label, SST, laid the groundwork for the independent labels to come.
Coward, ride the pole. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Make this sport what we say. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Try to stop what we do. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. When they can't do it themselves. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Way up higher, up your abuse. Try to stop us, it's no use. Society's out of control. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Make this smart, can't think themselves. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Laugh at us, they hide our back. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. I find that's actually what they lack. Rise above, we're gonna rise above.
Chuck Tukowski and Greg Ginn didn't want to get into the record business, at least not as label owners. They had a band called Black Flag, an angry, uncompromising hardcore outfit from the beach scene south of L.A., and they'd recorded an album called Damaged that Unicorn, a subsidiary of MCA, was going to put out. Then the president of MCA heard it and said, as a parent, I found it an anti-parent record. In other words, no go. So Chuck and Greg did what so many other punk rockers had done. They started their own label. In fact, SST already existed in the form of a couple of singles they'd put out for their friends, but they had no intention of getting into it full time. Black Flag were stars. They didn't have to do this. But, as it turned out, they did. And, while it wound up eventually sinking Black Flag, as Dukowski and Ginn quit to work with the label, SST became the prototype regional punk label, the model on which countless labels today are based. The first band attracted to it was the Minutemen, an intensely political, brilliantly witty band whose name came from the brevity of their songs. Touring incessantly, as all these bands had to do if they were to live, they just got better and better, and their 1984 album, Double Nickels on the Dime, was a two-record set with one song as long as 3 minutes, another fondly remembering their early punk days, and a cover showing their bassist and chief songwriter, Dee Boone, sitting at the wheel of the van that was to break an axle and kill him later that year. Boone died in Arizona, visiting a girlfriend. Perhaps she was someone he'd met through another of SST's star acts, the Meat Puppets, who were from down there.
Where the bad folks go when they die? They don't go to heaven where the angels fly. They go to Lake of Mud and cry. We'll see them again until the 4th of July. Oh, I knew a lady who came from Duluth, who got bit by a dog with a rabbit tooth. She went to her grave a little too soon and flew away howling on the yellow moon.
The band consisted of two brothers and a drummer, and every time they put out an album, they sounded different. Obviously, there was no SST sound, no doctrinaire mold into which its bands had to fit, and the Meat Puppets have continued evolving to where they managed a top 10 hit last year. The third band SST will be remembered for came from St. Paul, not, they always reminded you, Minneapolis. Another trio, like the Minutemen and the Meat Puppets, Husker Du was named after a Swedish board game, and their guitarist, Bob Mould, liked to roar. Their drummer, Grant Hart, seemed to like pop songs played very loud. This caused some tension in the group, and it came out on stage, but no one who ever saw them will forget them. SST issued plenty of records in their day, unified by a single criterion. We look for stuff that Greg and I like, Chuck Dukowski told me one day in their office. You're smarter with music you're comfortable with. Both the Meat Puppets and Husker Du were more comfortable elsewhere after a while, since there are limitations to what such a small label can do. But these days, when you turn on MTV and see bands like Offspring or Veruca Salt or Green Day or even Nirvana, you're seeing SST's legacy, bands that developed on a small, friendly, local label before daring the big time.
Ed Ward is a writer now living in Berlin. His series was produced by Phyllis Myers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Our band could be your life. Real names be proved.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, I'm Spartacus. Actor Kirk Douglas led a slave rebellion in the Roman epic Spartacus. Tony Curtis was one of the slaves. They'll talk with us about making the film, and we'll hear about a previously censored scene between Curtis and Laurence Olivier, who played his master. The scene is included in the recently restored version of Spartacus. And why do the Romans have British accents while the slaves sound like they're from Brooklyn? Linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Dozens of House Republicans gathered on the steps of the Capitol today to hold a rally celebrating their contract with America. They reenacted the ceremony held late last year when it was announced. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
House Republicans say they kept their promise to hold votes on all 10 items in their contract, did it in record time, and now it's time to celebrate. Majority Leader Richard Armey was absolutely euphoric.
Forgive me if I'm all smiles this morning, but the birds are singing, the cherry trees are in bloom, baseball is back, and we've completed our contract with America.
When it was House Speaker Newt Gingrich's turn to speak, protesters tried to drown him out.
Who believed enough in this process?
Gingrich responded by saying if the opposition's best argument is to make meaningless noise, it tells you why the revolution is winning. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
The House has approved minor Senate changes in a bill today creating a 5-member panel to monitor the finances of the District of Columbia. The city is perched on the edge of fiscal ruin. The bill now goes to the president's desk. The Senate passed the measure last night. It permits the president to appoint board members. Members must have a primary residence in the city or have their primary place of business in D.C. The district governor, rather government, faces a projected $722 million budget deficit. The president has endorsed the creation of the board, which would have veto power over district spending. Nations at the UN Conference on Global Warming have set up a procedure to beef up an international climate treaty, but they haven't agreed on the details. NPR's Deidre Berger reports from Berlin.
There was no breakthrough at the 10-day conference on a further reduction in carbon dioxide emission standards. However, participating nations agreed to set up a commission to work out proposals on specific reduction guidelines by 1997. U.S. delegation leaders indicated stronger language in the agreement would have been difficult to approve in the Republican-controlled Congress. The agreement was possible after the U.S. and Canada dropped demands that developing countries also start instituting measures to combat global warming. Environmental advocates, as well as many smaller developing countries, expressed disappointment with the weakly worded agreement on further carbon dioxide reductions. The current treaty commits industrialized nations to reduce emission standards by the year 2000 to 1990 levels. I'm Deidre Berger in Berlin.
The government says the unemployment rate grew last month 0.1% to 5.5%. Manufacturing jobs declined for the first time in 15 months. The Labor Department report is the latest to suggest that the economy is slowing down. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 13 points to end the day at 4,192. Declines led advances by a small margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. Army troops in the Philippines fought with Muslim guerrillas accused of raiding a Filipino town on Tuesday. 49 residents died. The rebels are still holding several hostages. The BBC's John McLean reports.
The Muslim guerrillas were reported to have been using their hostages as human shields in their encounters with pursuing troops. But a spokesman for the armed forces said it was unclear exactly how those killed had met their deaths. They perished during the course of a running battle between troops and a party of Muslim guerrillas reported to be about 50 strong. The army first located this party not far from Ipil a day after the attack on the town. The army said then that they had the guerrillas surrounded. But by dawn here, when the latest fighting began, the guerrillas had moved on. During the course of the five-hour battle, the army called in air support from helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft. But once again, the guerrillas were able to slip away, taking their remaining hostages with them.
John McLean reporting. This is a National Day of Remembrance in Rwanda. Officials in the Central African nation are hoping this marks the beginning of a reconciliation between Tutsis and Hutus. 1 year ago, the Hutu president of Rwanda was killed, along with the president of Burundi, in a mysterious plane crash. That triggered a genocidal bloodletting on a massive scale. Some estimates say between 500,000 and 1 million people died, mostly Tutsis killed at the hands of Hutus. The remains of more than 100 victims of the violence have been reburied today. Japanese police are still investigating the secretive sect thought to be linked to the nerve gas attack on Tokyo subways. Police raided several more cult facilities today after they found a large number of gun parts in a car belonging to sect members. Japanese police reports say authorities have found a derivative of the nerve gas sarin on chemical equipment taken from a sect site. Sarin is the gas used in the subway attack. Meanwhile, a lawyer for the religious group continues to deny allegations the sect is involved. This is NPR.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're looking at biblical-era Hollywood epics on this archive edition of Fresh Air. Back in 1987, our linguist Jeff Nunberg did a piece for us on accents in the movies. Today, actors take pride in perfecting accents that are true to the region and the period. But Hollywood used to be inconsistent about this sort of thing. It depended on whether you were in a drama, romance, adventure, or biblical epic.
Hollywood didn't used to care much about the authenticity of movie accents. Claude Rains talked the same way whether he was playing an English rake, a French policeman, or a senator from Montana. And nobody seemed to mind that Clark Gable played Fletcher Christian in Mutiny on the Bounty with vowels that could only have been shaped in Ohio and with never a word of explanation. Yet, curiously, casting directors did used to pay attention to accents in certain films, and precisely those in which accents should have been entirely irrelevant. Take the ancient Roman costume epics that flourished until the 1950s, Quo Vadis, Spartacus, The Robe, and so forth. There were strict linguistic conventions in these films, which, needless to say, had nothing to do with the Latin or Hebrew of the period. The Roman patricians had to be played by British actors like Peter Ustinov or Laurence Olivier. The heroes, Christians, slaves, gladiators, depending on the film, the heroes were played by Americans like Kirk Douglas or Charlton Heston. And in the roles of apostles, you had to have Jews or Irishmen, almost always either Sam Jaffe or Finlay Curry. This casting was crucial to the key scene in all these movies, when a Roman patrician, say, was interrogating a young Christian girl. The captain has these impeccable West End vowels, and he says something like, "This Nazarene you speak of, how many legions has he?" And the Christian girl answers, 12, my lord." 12 legions? Why have I not heard of them?" 12 men, my lord." 12 men? Why, what are 12 men against all that is Rome? Of course, sometimes box office realities intruded in the casting process. But in these films, unlike Mutiny on the Bounty, say, you had to put something in the script that would explain away the oddity. In Spartacus, for example, Gene Simmons was cast as a Christian. Her British accent was explained by making her a British slave. Never mind that the British in those days were wild tribesmen who liked to paint themselves blue and dance around the local henge. You weren't supposed to inquire too deeply into these things. In fact, these movies used accents to explain the difference between Christians and Romans, which, as it happens, was just like the difference between Americans and Europeans. As the American poet Randall Jarrell put it, "They are smarter than we, and we are better than they. Their sophistication has, unfortunately, made them bad, just as our naivete has, fortunately, kept us good." Nowadays, of course, movie accents in general are supposed to be naturalistic. When they remade Mutiny on the Bounty in 1962, Marlon Brando was required to play Fletcher Christian with a British accent, which he apparently produced by knitting his eyebrows together until his adenoids screamed in pain. And by way of revenge, we've had a listen to actors like Lawrence Harvey and Albert Finney giving us their versions of American speech. But curiously, the linguistic conventions of fantasy have survived. True, the evil empires of recent movies are operating out of Death Stars rather than the Seven Hills of Rome. Yet even in far-off galaxies, evidently, the Force tends to favor those who pronounce their R's.
Jeff Nunberg is Fresh Air's linguist. He's associated with Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center.
Slaves you were, and slaves you remain. But the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
Kirk Douglas was crucified in the 1960 epic Spartacus. He starred as the leader of a slave rebellion in ancient Rome. Spartacus was one of the biggest of the big historical spectacles, with big stars, Kirk Douglas, Tony Curtis, Charles Laughton, Laurence Olivier, and a cast of thousands. The battle scenes required 5,000 uniforms and 7 tons of custom-made armor. Spartacus even had an epic running time, about 3 hours. Douglas didn't just star in Spartacus, he produced it, even though after starring in The Vikings, he swore he'd never do an epic again. I spoke to Kirk Douglas in 1988. He told me that when he cast British actress Jean Simmons as Spartacus's lover, he was concerned that her English accent would ruin the linguistic pattern of the movie. I asked him to explain.
For example, when I did The Vikings, all the Vikings are Americans. We have a rougher pattern of speech. The English have a more elegant pattern of speech, so that makes it work. In Spartacus, you'll notice that all the aristocratic Romans are English.
That's right. They're great, great stage actors. Great British stage actors.
The slaves, like myself, were Americans.
Not only that, ethnic, right? Jewish, Italian. You, Jewish. Tony Curtis, Italian. No, Tony Curtis is Jewish too, actually, isn't he?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. I always forget that.
But it doesn't matter. You see, it's just that Americans have a rougher speech pattern. For example, I often think that Shakespeare very often is better played when it's done in the United States, because those beautiful lines take on a rougher quality that I think Shakespeare really intended.
So the slaves have the rough quality, and the Romans have the more genteel, educated, refined sound.
Exactly. Of course.
Was this intentional? Is this standard, or is this just something you wanted to do? Do you think it's pretty standard in epics of that period to cast that way?
I don't know. I never thought of it that way. It was just, you know,
okay. My
way of looking at the picture.
Since we're talking about Spartacus, let me play a clip from the movie. And this is toward the end of the first half of the film. Remember, this movie had an intermission. And Spartacus and many other slaves have escaped from slavery. And after they've escaped, many of the slaves are just drinking wine. They're having Romans fight each other as if the Romans were slaves. And Spartacus is saying, what are you doing with your lives? You should be doing something more productive. And he suggests that they actually fight the Roman Empire.
What are we, Crixus? What are we becoming, Romans? Have we learned nothing? What's happening to us? We look for wine when we should be hunting bread.
When you've got wine, you don't need bread.
Can't just be a gang of drunken raiders.
What else can we be?
Gladiators. An army of gladiators. There's never been an army like that. One gladiator's worth any two Roman soldiers that ever lived.
We beat the Roman guards here, but a Roman army's a different thing. They fight different than we do, too.
We can beat anything they send against us if we really want to.
It takes a big army for that, Spartacus.
We'll have a big army. Once we're on the march, we'll free every slave in every town and village. Can anybody get a bigger army than that?
That's right. Once we cross the Alps, we're safe.
Nobody can cross the Alps. Every pass is defended by its own legion.
There's only one way to get out of this country.
The sea.
What good is the sea if you have no ships?
The Cilician pirates have ships. They're at war with Rome. Every Roman galley that sails out of Brundusium pays tribute to them.
They've got the biggest fleet in the world. I was a galley slave with them. Give them enough gold and they'll take you anywhere.
We haven't got enough gold. Take every Roman we capture and warm his back a little. We'll have gold all right.
Spartacus is right. Let's hire these pirates and march straight to Brundusium.
There is a scene at the end that is a mass crucifixion, and you're one of the many actors on the cross at the end of the movie. And I'd really like to know how you were attached to the cross so that you could hang there without really hurting yourself.
Well, as a matter of fact, playing that scene, we learned an awful lot about crucifixion. We learned that it would be impossible to be crucified the way very often you see a crucifixion. The body would sag right down. But to make our scenes effective, it was very easy. Every cross had a bicycle seat that just kept the body up high enough so that you wouldn't be sagging down in a very unattractive position.
Kirk Douglas recorded in 1988. A restored version of Spartacus was released in 1991. It included a previously censored scene featuring Tony Curtis and Laurence Olivier. In a 1991 interview, Tony Curtis told me about making that scene. Laurence Olivier played the head of the Roman army. Tony Curtis played Olivier's sensitive slave boy who joins the slave uprising and becomes like a son to Spartacus. In this scene, Curtis is attending to Olivier in the bath. Curtis gives his master a robe, then Olivier talks about the splendor of Rome.
There, boy, is Rome. The might, the majesty, the terror of Rome. There is the power that bestrides the known world like a colossus. No man can withstand Rome. No nation can withstand her. How much less a boy? There's only one way to deal with Rome, Antoninus. You must serve her. You must abase yourself before her. You must grovel at her feet. You must love her. Isn't that so, Antoninus?
Well, you get the point there. Olivier is suggesting that Curtis should not only give in to the power of Rome, but to the sexual power of his master. It's very metaphoric. The whole thing is so...
Well, he doesn't come out and say, I want to stick it to you, dear. I mean, you know, he talks about snails and oysters. It's a clever way of... Or they think it's an artistic way of doing it. I would have much preferred the scene were a little more blatant in its approach because it would have been a lot more logical and perhaps a lot more realistic. But somebody thought it would be kind of fanciful to talk of fish. I really don't know why.
Well, I actually have the script from that scene in front of me, so let me read some of it. I won't pretend like I'm you or Olivier.
Well, please.
But Crassus, played by Olivier, asks you a bunch of questions. He asks you, do you steal, Antoninus? And you say, no, master. And he says, do you lie? And you say, no, master. And he says, have you ever dishonored the gods? And you say, no. He says, do you refrain from these vices out of respect for the moral virtues? And you say, yes. Then he asks you if you eat oysters and if you eat snails. And you say that you eat oysters, but you don't eat snails. And he asks you if you consider the eating of oysters to be moral and the eating of snails to be immoral and so on. And then he confesses that he eats both.
Yes.
It's kind of like swinging both ways type subtext here. So did you and Olivier really talk through the scene before you did it? You know,
absolutely not. There's nothing to talk through. There I am in a bikini.
Yeah, you're wearing your bathing trunks.
Standing over him while he sits in a bikini in a tub. I mean, it doesn't really take a lot of internal dialogue to describe or even know what's going on.
Do you remember any of the logistical problems in the big battle scene?
Yes, there was a scene. that was shot in Death Valley, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember now the exact location, where down in the valley were thousands of soldiers and men lined up, and the camera panned up and came up a hill. And as it came up a hill, it disclosed, I think, Spartacus on a horse. And just as that camera came there, the horse bolted and took Kirk off in a big steam of sand and dirt, and was never seen again in that shot. So we had to go do it again. It was a complicated scene, and that horse just would not, you know, pay attention to it. Because after all of the action, the camera would slowly pan and disclose that horse. So it had those kind of problems, you know. Charlie McGraw, an actor who was doing a scene with Kirk Douglas, and he was the what would you call it, the guy that ran the gladiator school. He and Spartacus, when they revolt, had a fight. And in the struggle, Kirk pushed his head, Charles McGraw's head, onto the edge of the barrel and split his eye open. You can see it in the movie, just blood gushing out. So that held up the shooting for a long time.
Oh, you mean he really hurt him accidentally?
Yes. So there were always accidents like that. I had hurt my tendon on the film, and at one point I just couldn't walk, so they gave me a cast, and I tried to, you know, maneuver through that, which worked all right. Let's see what else. There were a number of these things, a lot of horses falling down with people on it, people getting broken arms. But, you know, that's the nature of the profession, and we were all kind of prepared for it. We rather liked the adventure of it and the danger of it, you know. It all adds to the making of a movie.
Tony Curtis recorded in 1991. More interviews from our archives next week. This is Fresh Air. We love doing these archive shows because they give us a chance to play back some of our favorite interviews in a more thematic context. The Fresh Air Archive is just a small part of the larger public radio library. NPR has now nearly a quarter of a century's worth of tapes that document our times through news reports, interviews, and performances. Make sure public radio is here to inform and entertain us in the future. We're at a fiscal turning point, and we need your support more than ever. Thank you. The controversy over the new movie Priest has reached the newspapers even before the film's general release. Yesterday, Cardinal O'Connor unleashed an attack on Priest, calling it little more than the kind of things kids used to take delight in scrolling on the walls of men's rooms. Last month, under pressure from protesting Catholic organizations, the distributor, Miramax, agreed not to open the film on Good Friday as originally planned. Instead, it's been opening slowly in selected markets and will open nationally the week after Easter. What's all the hullabaloo about? Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Priest.
The Sound and Fury should have been predictable. Priest is the most blatant diatribe against the conservative wing of the Catholic Church in recent memory, and it doesn't bother to fight fair. The setting is grimy contemporary Liverpool. Young Father Greg, played by Linus Roach, is arriving to take up a new position in the parish. He's energetic, handsome, idealistic, and rigid. And he's shocked when he sees his fellow priest, Father Matthew, played by Tom Wilkinson, preaching leftish politics to the congregation, karaoke singing after hours, and, worst of all, sleeping with the housekeeper, who's played by Kathy Tyson. It doesn't take long for Father Greg to confront Father Matthew about such lapses, while the housekeeper listens from the next room. But Father Matthew and the housekeeper have both seen the likes of Father Greg before.
You're very certain of yourself, aren't you, Greg? Well, I'm not.
Yes.
few months in this parish, you'll be a lot less certain. A few years...
No, I've looked around at other priests.
A few years and you'll be utterly confused. A few years
and all those middle-aged trendy lefties jumping up and down with excitement every time a factory...
A few years more and you might just learn a little bit of humility.
Empty, fastening onto other people's misery, fighting other people's fights. Anything to fill the emptiness inside. Well, to hell with that. We're priests. We're not bloody social workers. We're priests. Moral guidance, for God's sake, Matthew. Moral guidance from a man with a bit on the side.
If you're gonna judge, you should know all the facts. We love each other. He's asked me to marry him. That means I'm leaving the priesthood, so I've said no. Well, not because I'm a martyr to the faith. It's because one day he might regret it, and I don't want to see that look in his eyes if he does. Anything else you want to know, I'll be out there washing your pots and pans, taking a scrubbing brush to your underpants. Okay.
So far, the movie is smartly written by Jimmy McGovern and directed at a sharp pace by Antonia Bird, and it continues to spank right along, even though what happens next is pretty predictable. Which is to say, Father Greg, despite his self-righteousness, turns out to be only human after all. In fact, he's having a gay love affair. As if that weren't enough to load this movie with big issues, a young girl has just told Greg during confession that her father is molesting her. And Greg, always trying to play by church rules, feels compelled to protect the confidentiality of the confessional. In other words, to keep her story to himself, even as the evil molesting father leers in his face. Then, with these elements coming to a boil and the audience on the edge of its seat, the movie falls to pieces. Which is to say, all those preachers on the screen spend the rest of the picture preaching. Father Greg preaches to a statue of Jesus, yelling, "You wouldn't give a damn about the church with its rules and regulations." Father Matthew, who becomes Greg's friend, preaches to him about how priests ought to be able to enjoy physical love, too. And all of this is interspersed with scenes of the earthly bliss Matthew experiences with the housekeeper. She spends the rest of the movie smiling beatifically at the good guys and frowning at the bad guys, just to make sure we keep them all straight. Not that that's ever any problem. The church elders who want to punish Greg for being gay and in love have been cast as the most laughably menacing sourpusses imaginable. One of them spends a creepy dinner table scene wearing a Boris Karloff scowl and scolding Greg in Latin. Even if you think Priest is on the side of the angels, and I do, the way it stacks the deck against the church's case is repugnant, and after a while, a bit of a bore. Still, what's bound to make this mediocre movie an art house hit is, of course, all those people noisily protesting against it. They'd be wiser to heed an old, or maybe not so old, proverb: he who pickets sells many tickets.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.